Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. One of the great questions left to answer for many, the most intriguing is whether there is, of the great questions left to answer for many, the most intriguing is whether there is life on other planets. NASA continues to work on that question with its current and planned 2020 Mars rover missions. Joining us now by phone from Providence, Rhode Island, to discuss that mission is Jack Mustard. He's a professor at Brown University and a chair of the Mars 2020 Science Definition Team. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Well, thank you, Anne. It's a great pleasure to be able to talk to you.
How did the findings from the Mars Curiosity rover shape the plans for the next mission?
Well, I think one of the really interesting things about the Curiosity success was just, A, it landed. I mean, if you think about
that's the spirit.
all our eyes were on that, and I know many of us withheld something in our body that said, oh my gosh, is this really going to work? The fact that it landed so successfully, so flawlessly, then said it's possible, not only just to land such a large spacecraft, but it's possible to do the next things. And then its actions on the planet since have certainly reinvigorated the ideas about, wow, we can take some really sophisticated tools and machines to the surface. But one of the things that came out of the way Curiosity is operating was, we need to operate more efficiently and to be able to really move across the landscape if we want to do the next things.
So what would be some of the differences that we'll see in 2020?
Well, what I think one of the outstanding recommendations that the Science Definition Team came up with was that this mission should devote a significant part of its time to creating a returnable cache. And what that means is to identify rocks that have huge potential, we think, to go after the question you outlined, is there life elsewhere in the universe or the solar system? We feel that has to be addressed through samples analyzed in labs on the Earth. Mm-hmm. In order to do that, you have to then figure out how to collect those samples, encapsulate them, and put them into a canister that you can really return. And that is a big deal from what we put out there, because it really sets a bar and says, this is what we think we need to move forward significantly.
Of course, Curiosity has collected samples and analyzed them there, right?
Correct. And I think it's made three drill holes. And when it makes the drill holes, it powders the rock. And one of the things, and they've been able to make great measurements off of those samples, but it's really difficult to do the analyses on the planet. And I think that's the part, that they got really sophisticated instruments, but it's difficult to get everything working to the level that you would need to answer that next question. Is there any evidence of life in these rocks? Curiosity will allow us to make progress towards that, but to really... Okay, so here's what actually is a key thing about what we say. Mm-hmm. Context is important. What I mean by that is, what is the nature of the landscape that you landed in, and what are the specific parts of the rock that carry the signatures that you want? So when you powder a rock, you've lost it, and we want to maintain that.
What do you mean powder a rock?
So the Curiosity rover has it's like a hammer drill. I don't know if you ever had the chance to drill into concrete in your house, for example, mm-hmm. but it's like a drill that vibrates very quickly, and it just makes a powder of the hole that it's going into. Mm-hmm. So you've lost all relationship between the individual mineral grains. And let's say there was a beautiful vein cutting across. Mm-hmm. And in that vein, it has a core and a boundary. And that boundary between the vein and the rock, that may have the signature we're after. And that could be really important. But once you powder a rock, it's gone.
So what would be the alternative when you talk about getting returnable cache? What would be different about what you would get in return if you did that?
Versus doing it on the planet?
Yeah.
So
wouldn't the cache still have been affected by the extraction?
Sure. The cache that we are recommending is that it's a core.
Okay.
So they're little cylinders of rock, maybe the size of a pencil.
Okay. and that it would be inside of that.
Right. You would. Yeah. So it's like if you were to walk around in the on a rock outcrop and be able to extract cores the width of a pencil and put them in your pocket, and then you take them home to your lab and decipher their story.
My guest is Jack Mustard. He is the chair of the Mars 2020 Science Definition Team. If you have a question or comment for Jack, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why is the search for life or signs of ancient life a priority for the mission? What does that have to do with whether we do manned space flights in the future and that sort of thing?
Well, I think if NASA could afford it, they would have their astronauts packing up their bags and getting ready to go to Mars. I mean, I really do believe that. And that is the destination. But from a scientific point of view, as you laid out in the intro to this, is that the big question we have is, are we alone? And Mars is a destination to go after that question. And we feel from a scientific point of view that sending, for example, a life detection experiment, in other words, an instrument that might give a yes or no on the presence of life existing today, that's just naive, I do believe. I mean, it's a harsh environment. It's really difficult to live there. But in the past, we think it was better. So we need to look in the rock record.
And then if we know in the past that there was life, that suggests to us that maybe something could live there again.
If there were life on Mars today, the kind of prevailing wisdom, and, you know, you can believe it or not, but the prevailing wisdom is if there were life, it would probably be underground where the conditions are a little more hospitable. It would still be a pretty nasty environment, right? Not a lot of water. It would be probably pretty cold. But to live very close to the surface, it's toxic. There's nasty radiation all the time. It's cold. It's dry. And so we believe they'd have to find a refuge somewhere deeper in the crust.
Traveling to space is expensive. That's why, you know, so much has changed now, even in the last few years, about what our hopes for as far as the space shuttle and that sort of thing. How did budgetary constraints shape the next rover?
So we were given, I think it was certainly on the top of my mind entering into this, because the Curiosity rover was a little bit over budget as it entered into its final stages, and that had ripple effects throughout the planetary science community because it made it difficult to afford things. Mm-hmm. So we stayed very, very cognizant of that, and we were given a target for how much money we might imagine would be available to build the instruments and the rover. But I want to go back one step in some of the questions you were asking me, which is actually one of the exciting things about the Mars 2020 rover is that it provides a place and space and resources for the human flight component of NASA to contribute an experiment that they think would be really important in advance of sending humans to Mars.
Okay.
And their recommendation, they were part of the Science Definition team, and they recommended that this rover carry an experiment to do in-situ resource utilization, or ISRU. And that's really super exciting because it says, here's an opportunity to demonstrate the technology you would need to cut the tie between Earth and your spacecraft. That, in other words, you don't have to bring everything with you. You can start manufacturing it. And I think that's a really exciting part of this. So in addition to the core science to create a cache, it's to actually generate fuel or demonstrate that we can generate fuel or other components needed for breaking the tie.
And how would you do that with solar? What do you mean?
Breaking the tie.
Yeah.
So the idea here is that, well, you would use what's available to generate, in this case, it would be to take the carbon dioxide that's quite abundant in the Martian atmosphere, and generate oxygen from that. Once you generate oxygen, then you've got that opportunity to not only use it for breathing, but oxygen is a pretty dynamic fuel. And that you could use that to power power your equipment or rovers or even your return vehicle, for example.
I guess what would the rover will collect samples for further analysis back here on Earth, and also look for ways to, well, you're going to have this experiment where they look for ways to cut the ties.
Right.
How much do you visualize Mars being a stopping off point to the larger mission of manned space exploration?
Well, I think that is a hugely important question. And I really sense and feel that NASA would love to, if it were within its capacity, to send humans to Mars. I mean, I really do believe that. In talking to the leaders at NASA, such as John Grunsfeld, who is the head of the space, the science side of NASA, and he's an astronaut himself, having fixed Hubble a number of times. He, as an astronaut, there's nothing that he wouldn't like to do more than go himself to Mars, but to send astronauts to Mars. Because I really do think that is a grand adventure. That is exploration at its top point. It's just difficult in this current fiscal environment to garner the resources to do that. I mean, if this nation wants to do the great things in space, that would seem to me to be a target.
How much is your budget for the 2020 rover?
Well, Anne, that's always an interesting question.
moving target?
Yeah, well, no, they gave us a clear number. And I'm going to give you a number they told us, which is $100 million.
That doesn't sound like a lot to
me. No, that's not going to fly a rover to Mars.
Okay.
That $100 million was what they gave us to say, in order to achieve the science, can you imagine an instrument package that could do credible science for $100 million? So that's the entire scope of, you know, you don't necessarily allow scientists to play with too much of the money side of things because, you know, you never know where we're going to take it. but we were told that the estimates that have been developed for this rover are around $1.5 billion, let's say, from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm.
And Curiosity was more in the range of $2.6 billion. And you'd think, well, why is it so much less expensive send approximately the same type of rover? And the idea that it was all new, Curiosity was all new.
Mm-hmm.
And the landing system to the rovers, to the wheels, everything was new. But now we get to refly those components, and it's not quite a commodity, mm-hmm. but there'll be some benefits of that.
You know, I know you're a professor at Brown University. Are you, like, volunteering to be chair of the Mars 2020 Science Definition Team?
Yes, I did.
I wondered when you gave me the budget numbers. I'm like, wait a minute. They're not paying anybody, are they?
They are not. No. No, this is, you know, science, we're an all-volunteer army. It was in January of this year, NASA put out a call and said, if you would like to be a member of this team, throw your hat in the ring and we'll let you know. And when you throw your hat in the ring, just let us know whether you're actually going to be available. So that's why professors, you know, we have, we are doing our teaching and courses, and we fit this in as our sidelines, so to speak.
Well, I'm glad you are, and I'm glad you could join us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Great pleasure, Anne. Thank you so much for having me on board.
Jack Mustard, he teaches at Brown University. He's also the chair of the Mars 2020 Science Definition Team. Coming up, we're going to talk about food and technology, so stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Take a room full of art collectors, a one-of-a-kind piece of art, and begin.
Last chance now, $43.5 million. Fair warning, I'm selling it this side, not yours. All done at $43.5 million. For you, sir, $43.5 million.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, buyers, sellers, and the gavel, the CEO of Christie's, next time on Marketplace from APM.
this afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Homeport Noble on Long Condominiums, offering home ownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring a diverse community with a mix of historic and newly built homes and condos. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long.
Spend your mornings and afternoons getting the best in NPR news and information. 89.7 FM brings you NPR News 7 days a week.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is not Wellness Wednesday, so we won't debate the health issues of eating beef, pork, or poultry, but we will consider how technological innovation is helping bridge the gap between the supply and demand for healthier, more earth-friendly agricultural practices. At the recent Hack Meat Silicon Valley event, organizers worked to develop tech solutions to some of the greatest challenges facing sustainable meat production and consumption. Coming up, we'll hear from one of the participants of this hackathon. First, joining us from New York is Danielle Gould, founder and CEO of Food and Tech Connect, one of the sponsors of the event. Welcome to the show, Danielle.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
First of all, what is a hackathon? How does that work?
So hackathons are traditionally events where developers and designers come together in a short period of time to tackle a problem and develop technology solutions. So, for example, Facebook, they'll hold a hackathon where they will put all of their engineers in a room together, give them a lot of beer and coffee and pizza, and then over the course of 24 to 48 hours, they'll come up with new features for Facebook. Those are some of the features that, you know, that we all see. And now the hackathon model, a lot of people are adopting the hackathon model. We've been using it for food and bringing in food industry stakeholders, in quotations, together with designers, developers, and entrepreneurs to tackle problems.
How was the challenge defined in this case? What was the question or the challenge you posed?
Well, we had six different challenges.
Okay.
So, like I said, we work with industry stakeholders. So we worked with the American Grass-Fed Association, Applegate, the James Beard Foundation, the NRDC and Grace Communications Foundation, the Butchers Guild. So we worked with all of them to craft what their major challenges are and to present them in ways that could encourage entrepreneurial problem solving. So, for example, for NRDC and Grace Communications Foundation, their challenge was how do we engage a million consumer activists to demand meat without antibiotics? Applegate was asking how can we increase the supply of sustainable meat by helping the next generation of farmers meat growing demand for that meat. So there are companies like Applegate, like Bon Appetit Management Company, you know, who their business is built on providing sustainable meat products, and yet there's not enough supply in the United States to meet their demand.
How do the foodies, the farmers, the environmentalists, how do they get matched up to work together?
So everyone self-organizes. The way the format of the event is we start on a Friday night where we have our stakeholders present their challenges. They have 5 minutes, give an overview, and then we have an awesome dinner where people can sit with, you know, kind of break up into groups and start to talk to one another and see if figure out which challenge they want to work on and also match skills with requirements. So it's kind of informal, and then on Saturday, people break into teams. We also work with design thinking facilitators. So design thinking is a new process for problem solving that really centers on using empathy in the design process, and it was pioneered at Stanford University and at a product design and innovation firm out in Palo Alto called IDEO. And so we have facilitators that help the groups work together, because we're bringing together, when you're bringing together farmers mm-hmm. with technology people and designers, everyone speaks a different language. And so it's really helpful to have someone who can facilitate and provide some process so that people understand how to develop a common language, how they figure out how to interact together and feel empowered to co-create solutions.
My guest is Danielle Gould. She's founder and CEO of Food and Tech Connect. We're talking about a meat hackathon they had recently, a Hack Meat Silicon Valley event. If you have a question or comment for Danielle, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, Danielle, tell us about some of the different ideas that emerged this year.
Sure. So, I mean, also more broadly, our goal is really, we think that technology can help sustainable food scale. Uh-huh. And the idea is that over the last couple of decades, food has become really proprietary, closed, consolidated, and has happened at the hand of a couple of multinational corporations. And so the idea is, how can we kind of bridge that gap and use technology to democratize how our food is produced? Mm. And so that was really, that's what a lot of solutions attempted to do. So the winning team was called Farm Stacker, which was an eHarmony, or kind of like an Airbnb-like tool that connects young farmers to land and capital. And so this was in response to the Applegate Challenge. And the idea was it was actually a young farmer was on the winning team, and he rents land from another farmer. And and their farming practices are very synergistic. So it's a cattle farmer, and then he raises chickens. And so the manure from the chickens is able to, or the waste from the chickens is able to help fertilize the land. And because he was able to use rents land from this farmer, he was able to reduce the barriers to entry, the cost of farming. And so they're looking to turn that model into use an online platform to help streamline that process and help other farmers lease land from existing farmers where it's very synergistic. So that was a really exciting project, and they won a bunch of support to help continue development. And they've been, since the event, they've been working, this farmer in particular has been working equally on farming and on continuing development of the project. Another example, and you'll hear from them a little bit later, is Biotic, which is a mobile app that helps consumers shop their values by locating antibiotic-free chicken and then allowing them to make a pledge to purchase it. And that was developed in response to the NRDC challenge. Another example was Beefopedia, which is an app that helps to educate consumers on and celebrates the quality of heritage beef. So this was in response to the James Beard Foundation challenge. Mm-hmm. How can we celebrate the unique flavors of grass-fed meat? And the idea is that grass-fed meat has there's a terroir. You know, they're just like with wine, how we appreciate wine from different regions. Mm-hmm. Grass-fed meat is the same way. So how do we make it more accessible? How can we help consumers better understand how to cook different cuts of meat and also how to appreciate the varying tastes?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Tech Tuesday, and my guest is Danielle Gould. We're talking about an event that was intended to help to develop tech solutions to some of the greatest challenges facing sustainable meat production and consumption in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is pride tracking what you were talking about? A farmer named Craig Rogers wrote about the idea of pride tracking, as well as educating consumers on the less popular cuts of meat. Was that the concern you were referring to earlier, Danielle?
No, that wasn't okay. The concern. But so in conjunction with the event, we also did an online conversation, and it's the third one that we've done, where we invite people from all thought leaders from all different backgrounds to answer the question, how can information and technology be used to reimagine the future of meat? And so Craig Rogers, who's the owner and shepherd of Border Spring Farms, he wrote about pride tracking and how you educate consumers on lesser known cuts of meat, and which is meant to support, his insights are meant to support the hackathon. So people were able to reference his ideas. I mean, he was really talking about how people, consumers need to, farmers need to be really proud of their name and putting their name on the beef. And when you can do that, then that helps with marketing. Because when you're selling grass-fed meat to consumers, a lot of it is marketing. And so the Beefopedia, though, was part of the James Beard Foundation Challenge.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, joining us now from Oakland, California, is Emily. Is it Bookstein or Bookstein, Emily? Hello, Emily?
Hi.
Hi. I'm sorry. Is your name Bookstein or Bookstein?
Bookstein.
All right. A freelance programmer and a participant in the most recent Hack Meat Hackathon. You worked on a project that Danielle Gould referred to earlier called Biotic. What problem were you trying to solve there?
We were trying to solve the NRDC's challenge. How do you mobilize 1 million consumers to demand meat raised without antibiotics? And that really came out of the public health crisis that's impending due to the use of antibiotics on factory farm animals.
So how will the app work to motivate? The idea is that it motivates people to seek out antibiotic-free poultry, right?
In a sense, what we imagined in the course of the hackathon, working closely with Jonathan Kaplan from the NRDC and Josh Wenderoff from Pew Charitable Trust, we realized there's a huge base of people out there, some millions of people who already are aware of this issue and know that, for example, chicken that was raised with antibiotics can cause bacteria resistance in their children and obviously in adults as well. And so there's a relatively large base of people who already are aware of the issue, and this app is really intended to allow them to turn their knowledge into action.
Okay, so how does it work?
What it did was, first you were presented with this pledge, so that consumers could take a pledge. I pledge to buy X amount of bacteria antibiotic-free chicken per month. You could structure it how you felt comfortable with your own budget.
Okay.
And then it would connect you with local retailers in your area who actually sold the products that carry the certification that actually means something. And this, again, is the original idea that came out of the hackathon. In the conversation since, we've had to go back to the drawing board a little bit. But the basic idea was then you'd be able to know where you could find those products that you want. And the basic gist of it is it's like a boycott, where you buy in mass from the people whose practices you support. So you'd be able to reward producers like Applegate by having consumers mass buy their products and be connected to those products.
So what are the next steps in the process of making that idea a reality? Is it out there now, or where are you in the process?
Yeah, so there is a website called biotic.org, BUYOTIC.org. That is a hackathon website. The way it looks now is not what it would look like as a final product, because you're given 48 hours to create something immediate. But the way forward from here is my co-teammate Max and I have been in touch with the NRDC, with Grace Communications Foundation, also with a nonprofit called Farm Forward in San Francisco that's working on something similar. And we intend to really use this great gift of mentorship that Food and Tech Connect has given us to really create a tool that utilizes the best of the knowledge from these nonprofits and from other people in this space and make something using our creative license new and innovative that allows these nonprofits to move forward with this campaign to rally consumers around this issue.
Danielle Gould talked earlier about facilitators, people helping bridge the gap in language and meaning and that sort of thing between the members of the groups. Did you have a hard time understanding what it was that people wanted or what they were hoping for?
That's That's a great question. I love the presence of the design school facilitators at this event. I think because, so if you think about it, this is a room full of people who've never worked together before, who have some have policy backgrounds, some had design backgrounds, some had agricultural backgrounds, and we're trying to speak a common language about how to solve a problem. And I think really that's where the communication challenge arose, was that the design thinking process is very much oriented around thinking about the user and their need and why do they have that need, and obtaining insights based on I guess it's empathetic thinking, and trying to put yourself in those shoes. And some people are much more solution-based and want to talk about just, you know, run through a list of solutions and ways to address a problem. And the two approaches end up in the same place, because you're both, in the end, trying to solve a problem that people have. But one way starts with the people, and one way starts with, you know, the solutions that you would give to the people. And so being able to herd a group of people.
No pun intended.
Not at all. Being able to herd a group of people through that process, it did require the design school to be posing the questions they wanted us to work on and letting us know that we could feel free to use hundreds of sticky notes if we needed to. that kind of thing.
So how long did you actually work together in this group?
The group formed on Saturday morning, and then eventually, you know, people did shift around a little bit, but the final group was finishing up around 5 p.m. on Sunday.
That kind of thing, do you get to be friends? It's a really interesting way to develop a relationship.
It was. Yeah, it was. I actually, I felt a little bit like a different person than I normally am, being in that context. But I did make some really good connections there and make some friends. The iOS developer who made the mobile app, the rough draft version, we're continuing to work together on this project. I got to know Andrew De Coriolis, who works with the nonprofit Farm Forward in San Francisco. And on Sunday, actually, I went to the birthday barbecue of the farmer that Danielle mentioned, the one whose team won with Farm Stacker, the Airbnb for young farmers, and got to see the young chickens he's raising. They're 1 week old. They're adorable. So really good connections came out of this.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Emily.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
It's Emily Bookstein. She is a freelance programmer and the developer of Biotic. And also Danielle Gould, founder and CEO of Food and Tech Connect. Danielle, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, more Tech Tuesday, so stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, immigration reform and the GOP. The big Republican debate of whether the party should go for diversity or go white. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Columbus Symphony. This Saturday, July 20th, Picnic with the Pops presents The Music of Queen, a rock and symphonic spectacular. The show features the epic arrangements of Queen with the full rock band, stars from the hit musical We Will Rock You, and the Columbus Symphony. Details at picnicwiththepops.com.
When you support 89.7 NPR News at the annual level of $85, our gift to you is the WOSU Public Media Member Card. The Member Card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 200 Member Card partners in and around Central Ohio. Save money and support 89.7 NPR News with the WOSU Member Card. Make a gift of $85 or more. Visit us now at wosu.org/membercard for more information.
A basic membership for 89.7 NPR News starts at just $60 and comes with our airfare program guide and a grocery tote. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. Two separate surveys in June confirmed that smartphone penetration has gone well beyond 50% of all adult Americans for the first time. That is a lot of smartphones and a growing university of possibility for smartphone thieves. More than 1.6 million Americans were victims of smartphone theft last year alone, and thefts of mobile devices now make up 40% of all robberies in major American cities. Wow. Huffington Post tech reporter Jerry Smith has been covering this crime trend and the black market for smartphones. He joins us now from New York City. Welcome, Jerry.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Can you map out what the black market for smartphones looks like?
Well, as you mentioned, smartphone thefts are rising in cities all across the country, and that's been pretty well documented. But what's lesser known is what happens to these phones after they're stolen. And my reporting's found that the stolen phones are fenced, and there's middlemen who buy the phones off the street from thieves, many of whom have held up victims at gunpoint and stolen their phones. And the middlemen take the phones and they wipe the devices, which means that they essentially remove any kind of data from the phone. And they also do what's called unlocking the phone, so the phone can be used on any wireless network around the world. And then a lot of these phones are being shipped to countries all over the world. One hot spot for these phones is Hong Kong, from what I've found and what law enforcement have told me.
When you say they remove data, do they take data in the process of removing it, too? Is there any concerns about that?
There is. I mean, our smartphones now have a lot of information, personal information of ours. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do online banking on their phones. So, yeah, I mean, there's a certain concern about not just profiting off the phones themselves, but, also profiting on the personal information that we have stored on our phones.
And how fast is the handover occurring when somebody, there's an armed robbery, they take your phone? How fast are they getting rid of the phone?
Sometimes within an hour. I've talked to police in San Francisco, and they've been doing a lot of undercover work to try and break up the stolen phone black market in that city. And they said that the minute that your phone gets, swiped from you on a subway or at a cafe, that thief can take that to, one of the computer programmers that he's working with who can wipe the phone, and then it can sometimes be resold within an hour.
How long, does it take to figure out how to unlock a phone? Is that something they're mastering as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually, in streets, there's bodegas that will actually provide a service called unlocking the phone. The wireless companies don't like that so much because if you unlock the phone, then you're no longer part of their wireless contract, and mm-hmm. they can no longer profit from your monthly wireless bill. But some of these phone traffickers, I've found, they use computer software, and they have these special computer codes that would allow them to so-called unlock the phone, and therefore it could be used on any wireless network.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Jerry Smith. He's a technology reporter at the Huffington Post. We're talking about incidents of stolen smartphones in the United States. They now make up thefts of mobile devices now make up 40% of all robberies in major American cities. If you have a question or comment for Jerry, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the middlemen who purchase and sell these phones, within an hour sometimes, as quick as that, from the thieves, are they the ones that are necessarily selling the phones? Do they have legitimate businesses? Are there storefronts and so forth?
I mean, they would say that they're legitimate wholesalers, and some of them are. But, you know, Sprint, the wireless company, has actually filed numerous lawsuits against people that they allege to be phone trafficking. And one of the things they're saying is that the phones are obtained from credit fraud, which means that they have these people, the traffickers have these people called runners who will go into, say, a Walmart or any store, and they'll buy several phones at a time and have no intention of actually paying the monthly bills on them. Those runners will then sell the phone to traffickers who will then sell them to buyers around the world. That's all according to Sprint and the lawsuits that they've filed.
And they make, I mean, they're getting more for the phone stolen, so to speak, than they
right.
are just what they're paying for it going into the Walmart.
Right. I mean, I think the thing to keep in mind here is that this whole black market is being driven by the fact that the price of a smartphone in the United States is much cheaper than it is in other parts of the world. Your wireless company will sell you an iPhone with a 2-year contract for about $200. But in other countries, the wireless companies there, they don't subsidize the cost of the phone. And in, say, Hong Kong, for example, an iPhone can go for as much as $2,000. So whether the phone is physically stolen or if someone has gone and paid $200 for the phone, you can sell that phone for a lot more money and make a substantial profit if you can sell that phone in another country.
All right, so you talked already about how police are trying to go undercover to get inside of these, I guess, chop-shop operations or however you want to describe them. But it sounds like there's a deeper problem here, and that is the larger world market for the phones is skewed.
Right. I mean, there's actually the New York Attorney General and the DA in San Francisco have been pressuring the Apple and Samsung and other smartphone makers to create what's called a kill switch. And what they're asking for is the smartphone manufacturers to create technology embedded in the phone that would render the phone useless as soon as it's stolen. You know, Apple and Samsung haven't really commented about that. The wireless companies have also created a database where if a phone is stolen and you report the phone being stolen, they can render the phone inoperable in the United States. The only problem with that is that once the phone gets shipped outside the United States, the stolen phone database doesn't work anymore. So the solution, according to some people, is to actually create this kill switch technology embedded into the smartphone. So once the phone is stolen, it can't be used again anywhere in the world.
What's a kill switch technology? Do we already know what that technology is?
Well, I mean, it's something that is apparently it's not actually out there yet. The companies haven't created it. Apple will tell you that they have a variety of features that deter theft. I mean, there's a software called Find My iPhone, where if your phone gets stolen, you can conceivably track its location. Unfortunately, that doesn't always work out, and the thieves are able to disable the software so you can't track the phone anymore. So what the Attorney General and the DA in San Francisco are asking for is essentially a way to make the phone completely inoperable, so you can't be used on wireless or Wi-Fi anywhere in the world. And a lot of people will say that Apple and Samsung have the capability of doing this. And there's some people out there who say that the phone companies or the phone manufacturers are resistant or reluctant to do this because they make money off of every cell phone that is replaced after it's stolen.
That's what I was thinking about as far as that skewed market goes. There's a benefit
right.
for everybody except for the phone owner.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I mean, that's been the criticism, is that these smartphone makers have been slow to act on this because they can profit off of people who have their phone stolen and then immediately go back to, say, the Apple store and buy another phone.
Why is it that in other countries phone. You described the marketing of the phones is different than it is in the United States. Why is it different? Why don't phone companies market phones the same way with as they do in the United States?
I mean, that's a good question. You know, I haven't spoken to wireless companies in other countries, but I can say that the wireless providers in the United States, you know, the Apple or the AT&T and Verizon and Sprint and T-Mobile, you know, they want you to buy a smartphone, and they want to make it, you know, an iPhone can cost, without a contract, can cost $700 or $800, and that can be prohibitive for a lot of people in terms of being able to afford it. So what these companies have done for years is they've subsidized the cost of the phone, and on the condition that you sign up for a two-year contract. And then the companies make up the cost by the monthly wireless bill. So that's been the business model for wireless providers for a number of years. And what's happened is that wireless companies in other countries don't do this, and the cost, the value of a phone in another country is going to be much, much more, and the profit potential can be a lot more if you can sell a phone that you've acquired in the United States in another country.
What do we know about what law enforcement has been doing to crack down on these activities? You mentioned that they go undercover and that sort of thing, but there's it must be a huge number of phones being shipped overseas.
Right. I mean, the on the local level, I mean, there's the police department in San Francisco, in New York, in Chicago, and in other cities have actually created undercover task forces where an officer will go undercover. I actually embedded with an undercover unit in San Francisco where an officer would be wearing, you know, a sweatshirt and jeans and walking around with a backpack filled with iPhones and would go around to this one area of San Francisco that's well known to be an area where stolen products are fenced. And he would go around and ask people, you know, hey, I stole this iPhone. Do you want to buy it? And when the person offered him money for the stolen phone, several other officers would swoop in and arrest the person. You know, it's unclear about how effective this is in terms of deterring the black market. As far as the phones that are being shipped overseas, I do know that the Department of Homeland Security is looking into this matter, and I interviewed a DHS agent for my most recent story who said that, you know, that there's a large number of cell phones that are being stolen and then eventually ending up in countries all over the world.
It seems like going for them on the street is like trying to stop a nickel and dime bagger, you know, from selling drugs on the street. It's those, I would imagine those people are the small-time operators.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a few police officers have described it to me as being similar to how drug gangs are organized. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a pyramid where there's at the bottom of the pyramid, you've got a large number of people who are stealing the phones, and then they're, you know, selling them to people above them who sell it to people above them. And so the whole scheme is organized in that way, sort of like a pyramid. And so there have been a number of arrests of people who have stolen phones, but the sense that I get is that these people are often very small players in a much bigger scheme.
What kind of money do the middlemen make? I guess there's a couple layers of middlemen, like you just described, but let's just say, you know, off the street, someone buys a phone from a thief. What are they willing to pay for it at that level?
It really depends. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the stolen phones, it depends on the quality of the phone. I do know that, you know, a brand new phone that's still in its box, never been used, phones that have been stolen by from cell phone stores, which is actually a huge problem in a lot of cities where phones are being stolen, not just from people on the street, but from a cell phone store. And they'll go in there and they'll drive a truck through the front window, run in and grab dozens of brand new phones. And the brand new phones they can sell oftentimes for a lot more than they can a used phone that they've stolen from someone on the subway. But the price really varies. I mean, it can go from anywhere from $100 to, $1,000. And as I mentioned, if it's in a country where, say, the iPhone isn't widely available, I mean, the value can go up over $1,000. So, a lot of these phones are getting shipped overseas. A lot of them are resold again in the United States. Mm-hmm. But, we're starting to see more of them go overseas because they're more valuable there. And the wireless companies are starting to crack down on being able to use a stolen phone in the United States.
Now, I understand that American and Mexican wireless carriers have begun collaborating.
Yeah, that was really unprecedented, actually. It was last fall, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and officials in Mexico created this partnership where wireless companies in the two countries would start sharing a database of stolen phones. And what was really interesting to me was a Mexican government official at this press conference said that they've seen examples of Mexican drug cartels using stolen phones as a way to communicate with the families of hostages, because these phones would not be traced back to them. And I think that was, that was partly the reason why this partnership was created. But unfortunately, a lot of other countries, the U.S. doesn't have relationships like that with other countries. So it seems as though they're cracking down on the cross-border trade of stolen phones between U.S. and Mexico. But the trade of stolen phones between the U.S. and other countries, they don't have the same arrangements with governments there.
Dave in Worthington, you're on the air with Jerry Smith of the Huffington Post. Welcome.
Hi. I was wondering, I've traveled to the UK, and when I bought a cell phone over there, I bought the phone separate, and I just bought a different SIM card depending on which carrier I wanted to use. How come we don't have that same capability here in the U.S.? Because if I buy a phone for a Verizon, I can't take it to Sprint or to AT&T and use it there.
Right. I mean, some phones do have SIM cards and some don't. And actually, one of the things that I found in the U.S. is that thieves would take a stolen phone and then they would swap out the SIM card with a different SIM card for a different wireless network, and that was a way for them to resell the phone without that wireless company blocking it. The big thing in the U.S. that they've been doing is trying to, they've created this blacklist of stolen phones. And if your phone gets stolen and you're an AT&T customer, normally the thief would try to, swap out a SIM card and use that on a different wireless network. But mm-hmm. now all the wireless companies are sharing the database, so that phone can't be reactivated on another network. And actually, this same very same thing, this stolen phone database was tried in the UK several years ago. And what the British police found was that a lot of stolen phones were ending up all over Europe and in Africa. And essentially, it dries up the black market in that country, but then the thieves get around the blacklist by shipping the phone to other countries.
Jerry Smith, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Jerry Smith is a technology reporter at the Huffington Post. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.